not this record! Singles remind me of kisses. Albums remind me of plans. And my LP records, and they're all scratched. Sound just like a record on a phonograph. Throw records on the wall. Keep those records playing. I am a DJ. I am what I play. Time to play B-sides.
Saw him dancing there by the record machine.
Change another ball.
Hey, mister, that's me up on the jukebox.
Jukebox Saturday night.
It's got a jukebox that pulls the toy, toy.
All the jukebox music.
May I say, before this record spins to a close.
Today on The Vinyl Experience, remembering the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy through historical audio footage and songs. I'm Paul Cavalcante, and this is The Vinyl Experience.
Has anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? Oh, he freed a lot of people, but it seems the good die young. Yeah, I just looked around and he was gone. Has anybody here good die young? Yeah, I just looked around and he was gone. Oh yeah. Has anybody here seen my old but it seems the good die young, yeah. I just looked around and he was gone. Thank you.
Marvin Gaye's powerful reading of Abraham, Martin, and John, the song written by Dion in 1968 in the aftermath of the assassinations and the sorrow of the pivotal year in the 1960s that kind of turned the modern world into what it is, many would say, between the political climate and things that happened in wars and international events. And of course, on the home front, the first time that the sweeping violence of both the assassinations and the campus riots and the Chicago convention, there was just so much going on that turned the world upside down. And so a moment of clarity in the middle of all of that was that very moving and immediate reaction in song by Dion, and again, Marvin Gaye's version on the vinyl experience. But there's a story to be told here, and again, we go to a vinyl record to track it to the original source, a very unique record that was released very briefly by a news organization based in New York City, Metro Media News. Their flagship station, WNEW, in New York City, gathered sound and reporting all through 1968, put together a year-end special, and then put out a four-sided vinyl LP recapping the year in news. It was called simply 1968, The Year in News. And as you'll hear, the segment that focuses on May into early June of 1968 tells a few parallel stories. I think it's valuable to hear them told as it's presented on the disc. Some of it will relate to Robert F. Kennedy's assassination in early June. Other things will set the stage for what would happen. This is a unique document. It's a vinyl-only thing, and it is an historic reality 50 years, a half century, after this pivotal event. Back we go to WNEW's newsroom, the audio gathered by their reporters, the anchors telling the story as it happened in their time.
With Dr. King's death, the movement that he headed is indeed lost. Reverend Ralph Abernathy tries to carry on. A month later, on May 13th, he will lead the Poor People's March to a muddy plot of land next to the Washington Monument.
As the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the leader of the Poor People's Campaign, all right, through the power vested in me, amen, as the president and as the leader,
yes,
I declare this to be the site of our new city, Resurrection City, USA.
But Resurrection City is almost a disaster. Physically, 2 weeks of almost steady rain turn the tent city into a swamp. And emotionally, the project generates not compassion, but antagonism. Congress does not act on poverty legislation. And by June 29th, the government orders bulldozers in to flatten the tent city. And Reverend Abernathy is sentenced to 20 days in jail. And the civil rights movement turns even further away from nonviolence to militant black power.
In Vietnam, in April, Allied troops break the siege of Khe Sanh. A month later, we will abandon the Marine outpost. The House, in the wake of Martin Luther King's death, will pass a civil rights bill. And in mid-month, the Justice Department will issue an arrest order for Eric Starvo Gault for Dr. King's murder. It later turns out that Gault is an alias for James Earl Ray. Arthur Goldberg resigns as ambassador to the United Nations. And in New York, a Barnard College co-ed named Linda LeClaire makes history of a sort.
Oh, I'm completely confused by all of the excitement and the different people's different attitudes toward the whole thing. I feel kind of confident that eventually this will result in exposing the fact that the Barnard housing policy is very discriminatory and very unfair.
Ms. LeClaire has created all sorts of fuss by admitting she is living off campus with a roommate, her boyfriend. But Columbia has a lot more trouble than a case of off-campus indiscretion.
I have asked you to leave this building. If you do not choose to leave this building, if you ignore this request, as an officer of this university, I have to inform you that we have no alternative but to call the police.
The issue starts out to be a gymnasium that Columbia plans to build in Morningside Park. The Harlem community is against it, and radical students at Columbia take up the cause. But soon, the gym is all but forgotten as the dispute turns into a confrontation over student involvement in university affairs. The student leader is Mark Rudd. The villain is University President Grayson Kirk. And the shouts alternate between Kirk must go and amnesty, amnesty, amnesty.
Any student who is arrested will be immediately suspended for an indefinite period. You got that clear?
There goes the chant inside. Amnesty. They seem to be determined to stay, judging by this initial reaction anyway. Dean Coleman now moving out down the steps, and the 200 students out here are picking up the chant.
Amnesty! Amnesty! Amnesty!
The students take over several buildings on campus, and it all comes to a head in early May when President Kirk finally orders the police to move in and clear out.
The students are now moving toward the police. Two lines are facing each other now. Some rocks are being thrown, and the police now are moving toward the students. And there they go. The police have broken into a run now, and apparently are clearing the campus. Several hundred police. Several students are down. Several students holding their hands up.
Don't hit me. Just don't hit me.
Now are in front of Low Library, pushing the students. The students have scattered now all over the campus.
By the time the night is over, hundreds of students have been arrested, and they're allowed charges of brutality. A month later, the Columbia graduation will be disrupted by student demonstrations. In the summer, Grayson Kirk resigns, and in the fall, as Columbia reopens, the Students for a Democratic Society try to get the demonstrations going again. But by this time, the spark is gone, and classes proceed normally. The Columbia demonstrations have their echo across the Atlantic in Paris.
It's really a very strange sight. Ranks of troops, shields and helmets defending the beautiful bridges of Paris. I'm standing on the left bank side of the Pont des Invalides. I'm standing in a small and dwindling crowd of students, some of whom probably would like to cross this bridge and march on the Élysée Palace, the official residence.
In Paris, the trouble starts as a student strike, but soon it becomes a general strike that cripples the country, a protest against a goal that is only settled when the embattled French president agrees to a general wage increase. The trouble, though, comes back to haunt France, which in the fall undergoes an economic crisis, and de Gaulle is forced, in order to save the franc, to impose strict austerity measures. And while we're on the subject of students, there are a few more rumblings back in New York.
The superintendent has guaranteed that there will be proper protection and the teachers will be able to enter. They're all going to enter as a group, and we hope that normal classes will go on tomorrow.
The trouble is in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, where 13 union teachers aren't being let into their classrooms. But Albert Shanker, in April, is optimistic.
No, we're not going to strike. We are not trying to close the schools. We are trying to open them.
And with that, we promptly forget about Ocean Hill. Dancer's Image wins the Kentucky Derby, but then is dropped to last place because it is said the horse had been drugged. The United States and North Vietnam, after a month of arguing about which neutral city to meet in, decide on Paris. And Mrs. Alice Crimmins is convicted of manslaughter in the death of her baby daughter 2 years before. And there is politics.
On the Republican side, Nelson Rockefeller has finally decided he is a candidate after all. But his decision makes little difference. Nixon, with no opposition in the primaries, keeps racking up 80% or so of the GOP vote. And on the Democratic side, Vice President Humphrey has joined the battle.
I'll be campaigning all over the country, and New York will get its fair share of our attention. There are 50 states, and we'll be trying to give our attention to most of them.
Senator Kennedy said yesterday that he would like to debate you.
You'll have his chance.
When, sir?
We're not in the primaries. The senator knows that. The law did not permit me to be. The filing dates were closed. When the primaries are all over, there'll be plenty of opportunities for us to discuss matters and individually and collectively. And
Would you debate him together?
Well, we'll be speaking. With no use of you fellows mapping out a fight card at this stage.
But if Humphrey isn't in the ring, Kennedy and McCarthy are. First on May 7th in Indiana, Kennedy wins. McCarthy is second, and Indiana Governor Brannigan, a stand-in for Humphrey, is a poor third. Then the roadshow moves into Nebraska. McCarthy's forces, shaken by the Indiana loss, go through top-level shakeups. Kennedy, buoyed by the win, gains confidence.
I saw that one of my opponents has been around the state of Nebraska talking about the farm problems and about the fact that he was taking care of cows when he was 8 or 9 years of age. I've come here to say I have 5 dogs at home. We'll see if that has any appeal. And then all of the things that we're doing for the farmer in my home. If you look at my breakfast table every morning, you know what? We're personally contributing in the Kennedy family. We're not coming here saying what we'll do in the future, but we're saying what we're doing right today. Of all the candidates, who's drinking more milk now?
May 14th, Nebraska. Kennedy wins.
We want to move in a different direction now, and I think that's going to be the great struggle at the Democratic National Convention, whether we're going to move in a different direction or whether we're going to continue with what we have at the moment. And I would hope that those who feel that the country should move in a different direction, that we are not that we can't have the politics of happiness and joy with as many problems as we have within our own country, and peace threatened around the globe, that I would hope that all those who feel that way, have views similar to mine, would join in this effort over the period of the next few months.
And McCarthy can only smile and say, wait till next time.
In the great westward movement in the history of this country, it was a relatively easy task to get to the Missouri River. Almost any wagon or any wagon train could make it to the Missouri. But the real test came when you went beyond that over the mountains, and we're on the way now over the mountains, and I expect all of you to be with me, and we'll all make it to California by way of Oregon. Thank you all very much.
The next stop, Oregon, May 28th. And this time, it is McCarthy who wins.
This is a very good night for all of us. And I said to those of you who were at the meeting in Nebraska on the election night that the record of the westward movement showed that almost every wagon train got as far as the Missouri River. But the real test began once you crossed the Missouri and started up the Oregon Trail.
I have sent the following telegram to Senator Eugene McCarthy. My sincerest congratulations to you and to your dedicated supporters on your victory here in Oregon. We can both take some satisfaction from the overwhelming expression for change the voters have once again registered. My very best wishes to you. Signed, Robert F. Kennedy.
And then, it is California.
The divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or in the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of time. The country wants to move in a different direction. We want to deal with our own problems within our own country, and we want peace in Vietnam. Oh, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible?
No!
Is that possible?
It could.
Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God.
I saw the assailant across, and Rosie Greer was throwing his arms around his upper body, and I grabbed him by the legs, and we put him up on the table.
Well, I didn't see the actual person, so it's going to be very hard to describe that, and I am in rather a state of shock.
I gave him a pair of rosary beads, which are from Ireland, I told him, and he looked straight up, and I was wondering what this meant.
I took his... Rosie had the gun clamped down on his hand, holding it so that he couldn't move it, and I took it out of Rosie's in his hand and handed it to Rafer Johnson.
I was about six people behind Senator Kennedy in a very big mass.
Mr.
Yuno,
report to the microphone, please.
Exit
Mr. Yuno.
From the kitchen, right off the stage.
I got a little frightened to see him looking straight up, but he looked...
He's in custody, Hill.
Oh, yes, he's in custody. We turned him over to the police. They manacled him there and took him away.
And all of a sudden, there were a lot of cameramen seemed to be there, were taking pictures, and there were a great many flashbulbs. All of a sudden, there were just a great many in a row, and I saw Kennedy fall, and I just thought it couldn't be true. It just couldn't.
I said, the act of contrition, I'm a Roman Catholic. A Roman Catholic is trained to do this in a case of any serious accident. I said to the president, the act of contrition, slowly and audibly, and he heard it. I'm sure of it. He was breathing. He's alive. Please God.
And then I just kind of backed up and stood there. I'm really sorry. It just...
And I said to him, Mary, Queen of Peace, pray for us. And with that, he took my hand and the rosary beads and tightened.
I have a short announcement to read, which I will read at this time. Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968, with Senator Kennedy at the time of his death, were his wife, Ethel, his sisters, Mrs. Stephen Smith, Mrs. Patricia Lawford, brother-in-law, Mr. Stephen Smith, sister-in-law, Mrs. John F. Kennedy. He was 42 years old.
Some of the principal celebrants of this mass are coming down the aisle now. Archbishop Terence Cook will be one of the concelebrants, that is, the men who together will celebrate the mass, commemorating the birth and life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This doctrine that Senator Robert Kennedy and his family and many, many Americans and many people around the world accept as unquestioned truth. Cardinal Cushing, older now, drawn, tired, the same man who eulogized the slain President John F. Kennedy, will be here. It's not certain whether or not he will speak to this congregation. He may offer a sermon, he may not. He's rather tied up in his own emotions, as all of us are. But for Cardinal Cushing, the Archbishop of Boston, this has come terribly close once again. It has for all of us. We might note, too, that President Johnson, in entering the great cathedral, shared something with Jacqueline Kennedy, a facial expression. Many of us have racked our minds to come up with some word to describe that facial expression. And for whatever benefit it gives us, the only word that I can come up with that adequately describes us is haunted for him too, as for the rest of us, the clock has turned back 4.5 years. Archbishop Cook goes to the altar, bends, and kisses the surface, and the Requiem Mass is begun, the Mass for the repose of the soul of Robert Francis Kennedy.
Silence. No. Mrs. Ethel Kennedy, over the coffin, praying. Behind her, Edward. Behind them, the children. Her head bowed just a bit, not deeply bowed. The veil hanging still. The crowd shields her from the slight breathe. Her eyes are closed. She's looking down. She bends forward. She kisses the casket. They cross themselves. They rise. Lights glint fiercely. Another kiss from one of the children. John kisses the casket. Soon the green turf will be removed. The rich brown dirt will be revealed.
Eternal rest grant unto him, O Lord. May he rest in peace. May his soul and the souls of the faithfully departed at the mercy of God rest in peace. Amen.
And the pallbearers return to raise the flag-draped casket. The flag removed now. They'll fold it into a triangle. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies. Shaking the flag. Folding it carefully. That will be presented to Ethel Kennedy. The firm wrists of John Glenn. His back to this large crowd, taking charge, slapping the rough canvas firmly and correctly into place. Joseph, the smallest of the pallbearers, holding the opposite end. It moves toward Glenn. The stars will be on top. Dillon, former Secretary of the Treasury, stepping back now. Glenn has the flag in a tight star triangle. He walks across, presents the flag. It is taken by Edward. John Glenn pats it one last time. Edward takes it, passes it to Stephen Smith, and then to Mrs. Kennedy.
Now the profile of Robert Kennedy can be cut in stone, just like his brothers. These two men in motion, their deeds done, are now anchored securely in history. Only 8 years from that time when they knocked the stuffiness out of the U.S. like the renting of a great bag of gas. The nation at the time seemed propelled by them as they led the young men in shirt sleeves in Washington who talked about solutions to the nation's problems with a self-confidence that was catching. They ignited dormant aspiration. They asked provocative questions. They encouraged action. Then one of them died. And then the other, at a time when he was attempting to renew that anticipation of 1960, died the same way, violently. Perhaps it is not beyond reason to at least wonder now if the turmoil the nation has experienced in the ghettos or on college campuses isn't in some way a residual deficit of those provocative questions unanswered, of those ignited aspirations sputtering, of that action now without direction. Such speculation is without resolution because it never will be known how a prolonged Kennedy administration or Kennedy philosophy may have altered our times. But we do know that the climate of the nation was changed favorably when they arrived, and its spirit deflated when they left. There is no way to judge what might have been. But it would indeed be wasteful not to salvage something of what might have been, not to recall, as Robert Kennedy did, that some men see things as they are and ask why, while others see things as they should be and ask why not.
On The Vital Experience, the aftermath of the Robert F. Kennedy assassination in song, as expressed by David Crosby, in the song by CSN, Long Time Gone, written in the long hours, the darkest hour before the dawn, sings David, and it was an all-night vigil for Kennedy in that first week, those tender days in June of 1968. On the other side of the Atlantic, the Rolling Stones were busy at work on a new song, and that process was being filmed by the French avant-garde filmmaker Godard. His Sympathy for the Devil would intersperse a lot of bizarre footage of things not related to the making of the song with the doings at Olympic Studio in late May and early June of 1968. What's fascinating about that document is how we see the development of the song through a bunch of different musical styles, but we also hear one clue as to exactly when this early take was recorded. Listen carefully to the words.
Shout it out, kill Kennedy, when all the time I knew it's just you and me. So let me please introduce myself. I'm a man.
And there you have it. Kennedy was singular. I shouted out, who killed Kennedy? That line would change to Kennedy's plural when the completed song was released at the end of 1968 on the album Beggar's Banquet. Here it is from the original Decca Mono record. It's a slightly different mix. It's a little faster. The balances are a little different. There's a longer fade out. And you certainly do hear the line, I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys? Plural, very distinctly, on the Vinyl Experience.
I rode a tank, held a generous rank, when the blitzkrieg raged.
America's number one song in the week of June 1st, 1968, and its famous line bemoaning the loss of an American hero, or at least the absence of one. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Special poignancy to that line in Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson in the week that would unfold in the news of the Kennedy assassination and the aftermath. The original mono mix from the 45. Before that, the original mono LP version from the UK of the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. And more 45s from this week in 1968, the romantic hit of the year, Herb Alpert's This Guy's in Love with You.
This guy's in love with you. Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do? When you smile, I can tell we know each other very well. How can I show you, I'm glad I got to know you, 'cause They say you think I'm fine. Yes, I'm in love. And what I'd do to make you mine, tell me now, is it so? Don't let me be the last to know my
MacArthur's Park is melting in the dark. or the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again. Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh!
That's the Vinyl Experience. Inching toward the top 10 this week in 1968, of almost cinematic scope, the Richard Harris hit MacArthur Park, the enigmatic Jimmy Webb song, a song of grandeur in big times, with big changes afoot in all corners of the world, and especially in the American life. Seek out more Vinyl Experience on your own time in the archives at prn.fm, the Vinyl Experience station 24/7 on iHeartRadio. Follow me on Twitter. I'm Paul Cavalcante.